The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the afternoon of day six of the seven-day session here at Mountain Gate in northern New Mexico in January 2018. And if you're alarmed at that news, that's good, because it means you've been diving in and committed to your practice. If you're not alarmed, then now's the time to recommit and go back down deep, 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 deep inside. The weather station here at Mountain Gate says it's raining right now. And yet, if you look out the window, you see blue sky, a little bit of high clouds here and there, wispy high clouds, nothing really big deal. And the blue sky shines clearly. It's a real metaphor for our mind. Our mind is like that blue sky, utterly clear, always. Clouds come and go, and the storms come and go. In fact, there's some pretty wild storms in Southern California right now, and they're causing mudslides, 4.5 inches in a day. That's a lot of rain. When I was working in architectural design, and we were talking about designing parking lots for buildings, the maximum rainfall that you have to consider for in various different parts of the country, and it depends on the part of the country, is only 5 inches. So it's nearly the maximum level of rainfall there. And houses are sliding down the hillside in shambles. The rescue workers pulled a 14-year-old girl out of a pile of debris that had been the house she was living in. She was covered in mud. Another man reported that at 1:30 a.m. he woke up suddenly because the electricity went out, and he heard this sudden sound and felt this big whomp at the back of his house. And suddenly his house was surrounded by 2 to 3 feet of mud. He was lucky that it held. He said, "Well, it looks like we're going to be here for a while." Our mind, our conditioning, our habit patterns conjure up a false sense of self that then proceeds to misinterpret what happens in our lives and get caught in anguish, certain amount of pleasure, always chasing after pleasure, assuming that that's a permanent thing that we can. Create or have, if only other people would allow it to happen. The only thing is, it's all up to us. Whether we experience pleasure or pain depends, of course, on certain circumstances, but it's not up to the other people. Other people are not creating our mind states. Our mind states are in response to what happens. And quite often what happens is misinterpreted. Now, I'm not talking about severe trauma here. And somebody's got a gun in at your head, or you're being raped or something like that. That's pretty serious event. But what we do with it years later is up to us. In the last teshu, you heard of dependent arising, the real map of how it all unfolds in terms of the creation of self. And now we'll talk today, sharing some of the Kathleen Dowling Singh's writings in her latest book called Unbinding, how to not go there. The antidote. And the antidote is attention. When a person is assigned to taking the trash containers up to the road on a trash day, and then on their own pays attention and brings them back down after they're emptied. Not the next day, but soon after they're emptied. This is an example of attention in action. When we work in an environment and then leave the environment and leave traces, that expresses a lack of attention. It's really important in our practice to develop attention, because attention is how we discover where we're caught and why we're caught, and move towards letting go, being caught in suffering. So let's share some of what Kathleen writes. In this chapter, it's called What's Going On Here? And then again, this is from the book Unbinding, The Grace Beyond Self. This is her final book. She died earlier, she died last year. It's 2018. She died in 2017. Samsara's quality of tension. Samsara is the realm of greed, anger, and delusion, the realm of illusion that we usually live in, the realm of pain and suffering that is really an illusion. Samsara's quality of tension, a product of conditioning and conditioned dynamics, all impersonal, should remind us to look closely at what is happening beneath the surface of appearances and assumptions. When we're feeling out of sorts, or if we're committed to Zen practice, anytime, no matter what we're feeling, if we search deeply for what's beneath this feeling, what's beneath this supposed experience, we're well on our way to becoming free of samsara. And she continues, we can recognize any level of dissatisfaction as an indication that our attention, here's that word again, attention, is trapped in ignorance, that ignorance is operating and churning out illusions. If we don't pay attention, we're not going to find our way out of this. We'll just keep cycling and cycling and cycling in this self-image that's identified as someone, often someone who's a victim, often someone who's insufficient, not good enough. Attention is a doorway. Attention is a Dharma gate. If we pay close attention to what's going on, not analyzing intellectually, but tuning into our body, feeling the energy of that discomfort, and diving beneath it, as if you were diving beneath the waves in a sea. My father, a long time ago, taught me how to dive beneath a wave. It's a very good way to avoid breaking your neck. But more importantly, when we dive beneath the wave, the churning at the top of the wave, we're beneath it. The water is more calm beneath the wave, and we can move through it more readily. It's not putting up a wall of resistance. There's another aspect of this reaching deep within, beneath the level of assumed mind state, and that is curiosity. Where's this coming from? How did this develop? And more importantly, who is it that's feeling this? Attention to what's going on is the first and most important thing. And then to bring forth a curiosity about this mind state. Explore it. And again, not intellectually. We cannot solve this problem of suffering intellectually. We can get a good idea about it, but we can't become free of it. We have to dive into the depths beneath it with curiosity to search its source and to search the source of the one who presumably is feeling this way. And she reiterates that. She says, it's helpful to train ourselves to remember that when stress and unease arise, curiosity is one of the most beneficial responses. The kindest, wisest thing we can do for ourselves is ask, what's really going on here? What's really going on here? And this is to stay out of the story, because the story is just going to recycle the stress, the anxiety, the suffering. But when we ask ourselves, what's really going on here? We're stepping out of the story. And we have the possibility of opening to what's really going on there. And the freedom that can come through recognizing that. This is exciting. So as you extend the out-breath, you're open to possibility. That curiosity is not something where you go down the breath and say, so what is this? What is this? What is this? What is this? It's beyond words, this curiosity. What's really going on here? Drop deep into the stillness beneath the suffering. And search. And again, you're not searching like you're searching through an encyclopedia. You're searching through allowing yourself to be deeply quiet inside and, as I said, open to possibility. And what may arise is insight. Insight into how that suffering comes about. And through insight comes freedom from that suffering. Of course, our suffering, and I don't know, sometimes you may not think it needs such a strong word as suffering, our discomfort comes in many different forms. And it's driven by the habit patterns of mind. We assume things about ourselves, and therefore we assume that what is happening to us is coming to us from outside and we don't deserve it, or whatever else. We have all kinds of reactions to it. It is so common to assume that when something happens to us, some discomfort, that it's because somebody else doesn't like us or somebody else is insulting us. Or somebody else is taking something away from us, or somebody else is embarrassing us. But feeling insulted, feeling embarrassed, feeling put upon, feeling not good enough, all is a figment of our imagination, conditioned by our habit patterns of assumption around ourselves. We're born, we are conditioned. Every moment of our lives, really, things happen. And we draw conclusions about ourselves as a result. And the biggest conclusion is that I exist. Whereas who we really are is a changing landscape of experience. There's no fixed self. But you can read that, you can hear that, until you realize it yourself. It's really very difficult to become free of it. But as you engage that curiosity, as you bring about that attention, really, really focusing in each moment, you'll move into a deeper and deeper ability to gain that insight into what's really going on. She continues, our willingness to see the hidden dynamics that have run our lives up close and personal can pop us out of entrapment in endless, mindless circularity. Inquiry is a creative act in that it introduces a new factor to that conditioned system. It disrupts the cogs. It's throwing a monkey wrench into our usual way of working, our usual way of assuming. And that can allow us to sit up and take notice. Well, maybe it's not how I assume it is. It's really, really beneficial to engage that attention in every moment of the day and that inquiry into what's going on. Now, of course, when you're engaged in a task, the attention is foremost. If there's a pause, or if you find yourself caught in a mind state, then to drop beneath the mind state and search wordlessly for the source of that mind state, for who it is that's feeling that way. But you don't try to do both at the same time. Not when you're doing a task. In the Zendo, attention is to experience the out-breath as a vehicle for the curiosity and the openness to possibility to become foremost in your mind. That is the path towards awakening. Attention, curiosity, as she writes, interrupts the cogs. Suddenly, your automatic conditioning can't operate as usual, at least temporarily. And right there is a Dharma gate, an entry into possibility to see through what's really going on. And in seeing through what's really going on, we begin to free ourselves from the automatic assumptions that we have about ourselves, about our life, about what happens to us, about the causes of what happens to us, and all the rest. And we begin to step towards the innate freedom that is our birthright. She continues, 11th century mystic Hildegard von Bingen noted, an interpreted world is not home. An interpreted world is not home. And don't we interpret? Something happens to us. Somebody says something to us, and we interpret the motives of that person, and we feel one way or the other, that we deserved whatever was said, that we don't deserve whatever was said, that they're out to lunch, that they're just on a roll trying to get you, or all the other myriad things we can conjure up about the situation, all of which is just illusion. It doesn't really matter what the motivation of the other person is. What matters is how you interpret it and what you do with it. Peace Pilgrim was a woman who very early on began to realize a way of interacting with people that brought about peace. And one of her earliest experiences was when she was in high school, I think it was, and she was working in a store, I think it was a dime store. And there were various different cash registers in the dime store. Some of them were in her place of working. One was assigned to her. And at one point, she didn't have enough change in her cash register, so she went to the one behind her and pulled out the change. And the floor walker saw her and hauled her in for interrogation. And she said, I was never told I was not supposed to do that. And the person who had introduced her to how she was supposed to work in the store had not told her, but was exceedingly defensive and said, oh yes, I did tell you. And the relationship immediately soured. The woman was quite angry and negative toward Peace Pilgrim. We don't know what her actual birth name is, because eventually she changed her name and just called herself Peace Pilgrim and walked all over the United States. In the 1980s, she was still alive. And eventually, in her late 80s, she accepted a ride from someone because she was going to be late to a talk she was asked to give. And the car had an accident and she was killed in the accident. But she decided that she needed to do something to help the woman get into a clearer mind state, fall out of the blaming, the anger, all the rest of it. And she noticed that on this woman's desk, there was a vase of flowers, and they were kind of past their prime. So the next morning, she came in with flowers out of her own garden and presented them and said, I see you like flowers here. Here's some from my garden. And gradually over time, just responding in such a way, and she didn't do it as a calculation. She did it because she felt that the woman was unhappy and she wanted to help her relieve that unhappiness. She didn't do it as a calculated thing of making the woman like her. And this is really important. And eventually they became good friends. Many, many years later, she was, for some reason, there was somebody, I think, that had difficulty with a neighbor. And there were all kinds of signs in the front yard of this neighbor saying, keep out, no trespassing, and all kinds of things like that, very, very aggressively so. So she walked right up to the front door, knocked on the door, and smiled at the man who came out and introduced herself and started chatting with him in a way that was honoring to him. And the result was very, very different. She had had some level of enlightenment experience early on in her life, which is what inspired her to take upon herself the mission of going about bringing forth peace to the degree she could. There are books that people that were close to her published these books about her life, and you can actually get them for free if you Google Peace Pilgrim. They're pretty inspiring. And there's another story as well. and this is not Peace Pilgrim, this is another person, I think he was actually a psychologist, who had a brand new car. And there was no place to park it but on the street. And he came out one day and somebody had made this big scratch along the side of it. And he sort of kept an eye out, and he began to realize it was his next door neighbor who was jealous or felt like he shouldn't have been parking it in front of his house, or there was something going on with this guy. Clearly he was suffering in some level, and there was a big self-image involved in suffering. And so this person, the psychologist, discovered that the guy liked to play golf. And so he bought a box of really nice special golf balls, wrapped them up as a gift, and presented them to the guy, saying, you know, it's almost Christmas and I know you like to play golf, I thought you might enjoy these. Very different reaction from banging on his door and say, what the hell are you doing scraping my car? I'll sue you. It changed the relationship totally, and the car no longer was damaged. Each of these people, Peace Pilgrim and the psychologist, were able to step out of reactivity, to respond in a way that understood the suffering of the people they were interacting with in these two instances. How were they able to step out of themselves? Somehow, they had done enough work between intention, attention, and curiosity to have freed themselves to the degree that they could do that. Our life changes when we let go. It makes a huge difference. I remember many, many years ago, suddenly realized as I was in the checkout line at a grocery store on a Sunday evening, and the checkout clerk was in a really filthy mind state, and pointing it at me, and I suddenly realized it wasn't about me. She was just having a difficult time at some level in her life. And there was such inherent freedom in that realization. I wouldn't have been able to get there without years of Zazen and a certain amount of psychotherapy. But we all have this potential. It's only this relentless, artificial self-image that seems so fixed that we find ourselves hurting, we find ourselves anxious. And again, I'm not talking about someone who's been seriously traumatized, although that can also add to the self-image. And as we continue on growing and developing in our life, we need to do some significant inner work to be able to process the trauma and let it go and not carry it around with us as a self-image in its own right. Continuing with Kathleen Dowling Singh, with growing wisdom, which is what comes forth from attention and curiosity, we come to recognize without a doubt that the cycle of suffering is allowed and determined in conceptual mind. Allowed and determined in conceptual mind. And this is why we can't think our way out of it. When conceptual mind is allowed to operate unconsciously, and this is where attention comes in, without mindful attention, it allows the conditions of dependent arising to proceed and proliferate, The ensuing cycle produces the complex, mistaken mental image of a separate self. And there's the recipe for suffering. We had to protect that separate self. We had to defend that separate self. That separate self, we see through the lens of that separate self and interpret things that go on in our life through it. And the result is challenge, difficulty, pain, and suffering. Attention and curiosity. Attention and curiosity. This is our ticket to liberation. But occasional attention, periodic curiosity isn't sufficient. If we really want to be free, we give attention every fiber of our body. We pay attention to what we're doing all the time. We attend to our surroundings. And when we're on the cushion, we extend that out breath, letting the curiosity ride on the out breath, seeking the source. Radical responsibility for our own suffering, seeing it, owning it, releasing our attention from identification with ego, is a sign of our maturing depth as practitioners. That's an important statement. Let's share it again. Radical responsibility for our own suffering, seeing it, which we do through attention and curiosity, owning it, which is our choice once we see it, releasing our attention from identification with ego, which is another choice, is a signal of our maturing depth as practitioners. Such responsibility or accountability, there can be no hint of blame here, and that's important. It's not like we see things and we immediately blame ourselves for what we perceive as inappropriate or dysfunctional behavior. It just is what it is. But in seeing it and with the remorse that comes up around it, or the awareness of the artificiality of it, we reach a point where we don't engage in it again, and our life begins to shift in positive directions. Such responsibility or accountability, there can be no hint of blame here, rests upon a clear recognition. A clear recognition. Seeing this suffering, which is the first noble truth, is the first step in cultivating compassion for ourselves and for our suffering world. A world saturated in, permeated by the universal egoic capacity for destructive hate and exploitive greed. It is, in every significant and meaningful sense, our responsibility to awaken and offer awakened presence. This is our bodhisattva vow. Manifest. There are a lot of things going on right now in the world, in the United States in particular. Our president has just suddenly determined that the Salvadorians who fled their country because of the severe danger and turmoil and terrorism and aggression there, and many of them have been in this country for 10 years, suddenly they have to be shipped out. They have to go home. Where is the compassion in this? They've made new lives here. They came out of desperation because death was what they were facing at home. And now they're being told to go back. At Christmas, I was sent by some friends, a couple, one of whom had grown up in Hawaii. Something that is quite impressive, and apparently is in law. From Chapter 5 of Hawaii State Revised Statutes 5-7.5, Aloha Spirit is the coordination of mind and heart within each person. It brings each person to the self. And this is not the egoic self. Each person must think and emote good feelings to others. In the contemplation and presence of the life force, Aloha, the following Unuhi, Laula, Loa may be used. Akahai, meaning kindness to be expressed with tenderness. Lokahai, meaning unity to be expressed with harmony. Olu olu, meaning agreeable to be expressed with pleasantness. Ha'a ha'a, meaning humility to be expressed with modesty. Ahonui, meaning patience to be expressed with perseverance. These are traits of character that express the charm, warmth, and sincerity of Hawaii's people. It was the working philosophy of Native Hawaiians and was presented as a gift to the people of Hawaii. Aloha is more than a word of greeting or farewell or a salutation. Aloha means mutual regard and affection and extends warmth in caring with no obligation in return. Aloha is the essence of relationships in which each person is important to every other person for collective existence. And in this holiday message, my friends wrote about that. That's all quoted from the law. And their comment is, Aloha is the law in Hawaii. In these troublesome times, we should all live with Aloha this new year and always. Attention, awareness, and curiosity. Attention, awareness, and curiosity. The willingness to doubt that what we perceive is the real truth. Everyone is here because of some level of discomfort. Call it suffering or not, for some of you it is real suffering. But the way out of that is attention, awareness, curiosity, and a willingness to own what comes forth through that attention, awareness, and curiosity. And a willingness to let it go, to surrender. And you don't even know what you're surrendering to. True liberation is reached through dedicated attention, awareness, and curiosity. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.